You're listening to Your Rivers Are Wrong, the podcast. My name is Merle. I'm here with my good friend Dante, and we're here to build worlds and tell their stories. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Well, hey there. So nice of you to drop by. Welcome, maybe even welcome back to the Your Rivers Are Wrong podcast. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Dante.
Yes, and I'm your other co-host, and my name is Merle.
Yeah, and today, as with all days before and forevermore, we've got another episode filled with ideas and insights on world building.
Yeah.
And the art and appeal of storytelling through this unique medium. We're going to pretend like this is the first time we recorded this intro. But it's fine. It'll keep going.
We're super professional. Uh-huh.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Of course.
Yeah.
Now, we've each chosen our own topics to bring to the table today. But before that, I just wanted to say that your Christmas card finally arrived in my mailbox, and it was just the warmest thing I've ever read in a long time. And oh boy, crazy. Shipping across the Atlantic Ocean does take a little bit of time.
I know. I have to say, I was also late myself, but not so late that you should have gotten that card only now.
That's
but,
fine.
You know,
that's
I can totally blame this on the post service. No, they're great.
Yeah, they're doing their best.
At least it finally arrived. Yeah.
Yeah. I just have to confirm, you drew the cover of the card, right?
Yes, I did. Yes,
that's
I did.
That's crazy. I looked at it, I'm like, this art style looks familiar. Let me just make sure.
I think this year I finally took put all the effort and made homemade ones where I illustrated
that's
the thing.
Awesome.
And then I had an appointment at the printer, and he was like, if you deliver this before 11 o'clock, you can still pick it up this day. And I was rushing for my life, but I'm happy I did. Because now you got a good card. Yeah.
Let's see. What else did I want to... Anything you wanted to discuss before the podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a thing. Last time, we talked about academia, our beloved subject, dark academia. And I can't believe, after I listened to your edit again, right before we uploaded it, I can't believe I didn't mention this one work that I love, because it's literally the sort of the holy grail of dark academia, and I didn't mention it. I can't believe it.
Oh, do tell.
Here you go. It's the big, classic, beautiful book, The Secret History by Donna Tartt, and everyone should love it. It's a brick of a book. It's giant. It's heavy and serious, and people smoke in it all the time, and they're super snobby, and it's one of my most favorite books ever, and I wanted to mention this because it has to be in here. I can't believe I forgot about it. So there you go. I did it.
I've never heard of that book. Is that a series? Is that a singular book?
It's one giant work. I think it's 1,000 pages or something. I don't want to discourage people, but it's definitely worth it. And I think Donna Tartt has one book written, one book every 10 years or something. And it's always this giant ones. And I instantly bought her other ones, and then I didn't like them. But I love, 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 love The Secret History. And if you like academia, you gotta read it, man. It's great.
I'll look around for it. It's been a while since I've looked for a book in particular. That is crazy. Is this an older book? Is this just recently?
I think it's pretty... No. It's not very recent. It's also, I feel it's quite sort of a classic one already, because it's so part of the academia genre. I think it's 1990 or something. I'm not quite sure.
Ooh, okay, okay.
But it's,
okay.
Yeah, it's cool. Quite a bit away. But yeah, it's really good. I don't want to frighten you because I'm so enthusiastic and angry about myself that I didn't say it before. But it's really good.
Nah, that's fine.
Now it's part of the canon. There we go.
You always remember the coolest things a day later after you're done recording.
I know.
I totally missed something.
I've come across this now. Yep. I made this mistake.
Yeah, I actually meant to bring up last episode again, the academia, is that I play on a Dungeons & Dragons Discord server that is specifically set in an academic setting. So it's literally a school, and everybody's kind of in college, and we all go through the years at the same time. And the thing that drew me to it in the first place was that it's set in magical New York. The setting is literally
that's
New York City, and every borough is changed in a separate, unique way, in a magical way. And what really piqued my interest is that the majority of the server is not from New York. So I get to see how they've kind of interpreted my city in little ways. And it's the most charming thing.
Oh, do they get it right? Or is it very funny if they get it wrong? Can imagine.
The geography and all that is a little bit out there, but they get most of the big landmarks right. And the rest of it doesn't really matter because it's a fantasy setting. But it's so fun what they've turned certain places into. Like some places are like entirely desolate and some places are like super rich, and it's just like, aww. Yeah, this is probably what it looks like.
I love it. I love that it's just sort of the idea of magic like in general, like the idea of New York and then also magic, even though like what actual New York is.
Yeah, like all the landmarks are the same. It's just super nice. So just sitting there and kind of watching it and seeing what they've done to the place is really entertaining.
Love that.
Last thing I wanted to bring up before we actually jump into the main podcast is that because we're kind of using the top of the episode as like a sort of errata for our previous ones, I went ahead and looked up information on Boxing Day, which we talked about.
Oh, man.
We talked about it a bit on episode two. So are you ready for a few fun facts? Yeah, here we go. Boxing Day is celebrated in a number of countries, but originated in Great Britain. And though there are a couple of theories about how it got its name, the prevailing one refers to the Christmas box, a gift given to public servants like postmen and errand boys for their good service throughout the year. In modern day, it's always celebrated on the 26th or the second day of Christmastide, which is a string of Christmas-themed celebrations. And in recent years, has become, as we mentioned, a holiday where discounts are found in many shops. So there you go. Thank you to my Canadian friends who helped me sort that out and figure out what exactly.
Thanks, Canada.
That was great. Thank you, Canada.
This is good trivia.
Yeah, I'm glad we sorted that out.
Because I want this. Yeah, we should definitely keep this a thing now because it's very useful if you forget things that we can still say them.
Yeah, if you want to check out our Boxing Day discussion, that's episode 2, and Academia is episode 3.
So it's like a footnote to our previous stuff.
I imagined just one Canadian listener is like seething as they're talking about Boxing Day. Like, no, that's all wrong. They've got it all wrong.
You know? Probably, yeah. But we've redeemed ourselves, I think. At least
hopefully,
a bit.
Hopefully.
Right? Yeah. On the topic of dark academia, my topic, if I can start this off.
Of course.
Is a little bit related to where I started, I think, last time when we discussed academia. Because I wanna talk a little bit about music and how it sort of influences a game or a book or how you can sort of incorporate it. Because last time I told you that I'm super into these playlists now, right? Where people just make like an hour long fancy classical music and they call it waltzing with the enemy and stuff like that, you know? And I think music for me, because I was thinking about this, like in what places does it influence me or can it be a part of storytelling or world building, right? And then the first thing was for me, I think the most obvious one, which is when I'm writing or when I'm prepping a game of D&D or, you know, anything, when I'm preparing or planning to storytell, I guess, I often put on music and it takes me like a good 10 minutes to find a proper playlist because it has to be the right vibe, you know? It's got to be so specific because then when I need a mood that's kind of melancholy but kind of uplifting, I skip through like 10 songs or 10 playlists before I get like a thing that I'm like, yeah, this is kind of what works. And it's pretty
absolutely.
It's pretty hard. Do you do this too? Or is this
just
me?
So when planning for D&D sessions, there's always like a 15 to 20 minute or even longer time set aside for me to just be like, okay, what music am I playing during this session? Like what matches each scene? And you can't just look up melancholy but eventually uplifting music instrumental 1 hour, you know?
At some point you've seen them all. Time. Yeah, it's a problem. Yeah. Do you use music in every game that you run?
Yeah, I have a small list of songs that are just kind of generically good in every situation. There is a musician named Jeremy Soule, and he has just a bunch of, he has an anthology of music that is seen in games like Skyrim, so large scale adventure games. And it always kind of matches at least the intro mood to the session. And then I can kind of branch off into more exciting music or more tense music, but it's, still, every session, I always feel like I got to get it just right because the music behind whatever they're playing or whatever they're doing is so important into setting the mood and setting the scene.
Do you also feel like you have to change things halfway if things go differently or if the mood changes?
Oh, yeah.
Or do you always kind of make it work with the music that you prepped?
No, of course. I have said in session with my players, I'm like, all right, just give me a second. Just going to change the track. I feel like the mood has shifted. The vibe has changed. So let me just set this one up. And then I play the music and they're like, oh no, he's playing the battle music. Something's about to happen.
What does
you know?
It mean? Yeah. It's good power to have. I have to say, I've been having a bit of trouble with it since the bots on Discord that I usually used have been like in and out so much because of, I think, a copyright claim or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Because now I have to, every session I'm reminded because the bot doesn't work, that the bot doesn't work. Then the first 10 minutes, it's always like, oh, fuck, I got to figure this out now. I've been doing that for like 4 sessions and I really should figure it out now that I think about it because it's super annoying. But yeah, so I've just been like, hey, here's a 1 hour long video game music. Let's go generic, nice. And then yeah, just exactly. One thing, you know, but it doesn't really work. Yeah, it's nice to be able to shift it around.
Yeah, I believe I started a Google Sheet for myself a while back of just music that I liked, and I would set keywords next to it. So I would write, I'd put the link and I'd be like calming, ambient, wide open field. And then I'd put like a small description being like, this is a song of rest. This is a place where the players aren't stressed out.
Oh,
and I'd
okay, kind of
leave
okay.
that there. And then I put it like, and I'd have a growing list. Some would be like ominous. Some would be like charming or whimsical. And some would be like tense. And some are like mournful. Like those keywords help me figure out really quickly what the song is about before I grab it for the session.
That's very nice. Yeah, I like that method. So you have like a big archive now, kind of.
Yeah. And sometimes music feels like an intangible. Like it's.
What does that mean?
Some scenes don't work the same way if there's not music behind it. And sometimes that could just be a failing of like the verbal narrative that I speak. I'm not being able to hit the right mood points with the words that I say. But I'm reminded of a video I saw a long time ago, actually, like in the early days of YouTube, where there was a scene of a car. It's kind of like the opening shot of a movie, a scene of a car driving down a long road. There's a big grassy field on both sides, and they're like traveling through, I don't know, some sort of route in the Midwest or something like that. And they would play this scene over and over and over again, like 5 or 6 times, but each time there'd be a different music track behind
it. Oh, interesting.
And yeah, so one is like, you know, charming banjo and guitar, and you can feel the scene is like the opening to a road trip movie. But then they change it to something like a little more quiet and ominous, and it's like, oh wait, maybe maybe this isn't going to turn out so great. And those little things, the things that music adds to it, is wordless. There's no lyrics to those songs. Nobody telling you it's going to be dangerous. You know, there's no like implicit. It's like the audience implicitly understands the music means something. It's going to tell you something.
Interesting. I like that.
And that's just background music. There's so many little things that bodies of art as a collection with multiple pieces of music to continue to set like a scene behind a scene. It's like how like instead of a movie, like without any sort of visual, that's how things like podcasts and readouts or whatever they're called when people read a book, like audiobooks. That's how like how you can kind of paint a picture without having to describe the sky is dark and stormy, it's rainy everywhere, you know. People can kind of just get the mood from the music behind it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think music is also, it's nice that you touched upon this a little bit already. What I also love when it's specifically more of a cinematic device, and I'm saying cinematic, but I don't necessarily always mean in movies, because you're definitely right with the audiobook thing, because that's also very much immersive and sort of atmospheric, you know, when music is added to that. But I think specifically, I remember, I'm going to talk about it again, but it's a good series. Last Agni Kai between Zuko and Azula in Avatar.
In The Last Airbender, yep.
Yeah, where they have like sort of a final firebending battle that is sort of about everything that the whole series have set them up for.
Exactly.
Right? And to paint a little picture here, they've never been on good terms with each other. Azula is super dangerous. Zuko is finally sort of coming around and on the good side now. So they have this sort of ultimate clash, and that happens in this firebending battle. The only thing that we see on the screen is a sort of wide shot, so from far away, of these two incredible, super powerful benders, both with their own color of fire. So you have the like the super bright blue fire and bright orange fire. And you don't hear any like foley. There's no footsteps. There's no screaming. There's nothing. You just hear this sort of, I think it's a string or a cello piece or something. It's super sad. And you just feel the impact and the weight of it. Very often I'm thinking this is such a good musical choice to put only music here and nothing else, because it completely sort of isolates the whole scene from
exactly,
the already great series. But, you know, it's super impactful because of that. And I think there's more instances of that. It also made me think of, I think it's a 2009 or 2012 or something movie with Keira Knightley, I think, where she did the Anna Karenina movie. And there's one scene in that. This is sort of a classic costume drama, right? And there's one scene where the sort of love interest and Anna Karenina meet each other in a sort of waltz. And at some point, this music sort of swells and suddenly all the people around them are stuck in time and they just keep on dancing forever. And at some point, everybody's gone and this music is super intense and you only see them as if they're in a sort of spotlight and the rest of the world doesn't exist. You know, and sort of the balance between realism, but also sort of in story versus out of story music, because the waltz is played, you know, they are dancing on it. It's super interesting to me. And I think it's such a nice, I don't know, storytelling device, but it also changes up the whole experience if you use it wisely.
Especially with the Agni Kai scene. There is an Agni Kai song, like the very intense, like kind of drums and build up and the chanting that plays all throughout the series. And then with the final Agni Kai-esque battle, they don't use that music at all. It's as if that that emotion has passed and it's been replaced with this mournful track. And it's something that the fact that like music can kind of predispose you to think about certain scenes in certain ways is something that you obviously know. It's used incredibly well in as motifs in musicals. You know, one of my favorite examples, and the more I look into it and the more I re-listen to the track, the OST, the more I realize Hamilton is just a it's a masterpiece in musical design.
Of course,
because every character has their own little riff, their own little theme. It might just be a couple of notes in a sequence. It might just be like a key or a very simple thing. And every time that little motif comes up, the characters are talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know how, I'm not about to sing on podcast, but Eliza has those, the notes that follow her name, like Eliza, something like that. And that's just thrown into songs. Like any time she's brought up and you're reminded immediately of her scenes. And as the play goes on, right, as the musical goes on, you build more and more and more of these motifs. So the songs towards the end, as with a lot of musicals, they're just pulling motifs left and right. They're like, oh, remember this, remember this, remember this. Mm-hmm. And they're blended so nicely into a singular song that it's like reading between the lines in audio form. It's so, so nice.
I love it too, because it doesn't feel like you're sort of explicitly saying something as the composer, but you definitely are. But it's so, I don't want to say subconscious, but sort of intuitive or something is the better word, I think. I think there's a YouTuber called Sideways that does a lot of super nice video essays on this. And he talks a lot about leitmotifs and stuff. And it's really nice how there can sort of be a subtext or a sort of melodic subtext under whatever you're saying. Because as soon as you, for instance, I don't exactly remember how where Hamilton used, for example, the Eliza motif. But as soon as you would put it in, I don't know, a scene that's about mourning or about anger, suddenly you're linking that person with whatever is going on, you know, in front of your eyes, literally, like in the first quote unquote layer of the story. And it's really nice.
And sometimes it's not even like, it's not even spoke out implicitly. They might not even mention the character, but just throwing it into the subtext of the music, it's something you kind of realize later. It's like, oh, they were talking about this person.
Yeah, for sure. It's super interesting. Hamilton's great. Ugh. You know, Dante, this is one of the reasons that I should live in New York. Maybe the only reason, like musicals.
You can come by anytime, I swear. The doors are open.
I'm going to watch all the musicals, all of them.
You're going to just schedule a week of musicals? Absolutely.
I'm not even kidding. This is like a real thing that has to happen if I ever go there.
Come through. you got to time it just right because, you know, Broadway's are open and closing, you know.
I was just
going to
say, like theaters has been closing again here in Holland lately because of the COVID situation. And I'm so craving theater. Oh, I hate it. I don't like this. It's so sad. I mean, necessary and everything, like I don't have to talk about this with you, of course, but you know, I miss theater, man. Theater's great.
Listen, Broadway was open for like a solid portion of fall. Like all the shows were coming back, everything was getting ready. And then like nowadays it's like, okay, limited seating, limited tickets. Some things are just straight up closed now. It's just not a good time.
It's it's intense.
Yeah.
I don't know how we ended up here. Speaking of musicals, I also had to think of the YouTube musical. I don't know if that's the right word. There's a channel called Star Kid, and it's pretty...
Yes, I know Star Kid.
Oh, you know of them? Absolutely. Great.
Yeah.
They usually do, I think, every year or a little bit longer. I'm not sure. They post like a full original musical there, and they film it really nicely. So it's a super fun watch. And usually they're super quirky and random, which is great.
Yeah.
But then, I guess it's still quirky. But the one that I want to talk about is the one that also does a lot with music integrated in story. And it's the one that's called The Guy Who Didn't Like Musicals.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
It's literally a musical piece. The main character is Paul. And Paul is the guy who didn't like musicals. He doesn't like them and he hates musicals and he wants nothing to do with it. And he has a nice, simple office corporate job. And at some point, I won't spoil it too much because it's really fun. You should definitely check it out. But at some point, everybody around them suddenly starts bursting out in song as if he was in a real life musical and he hates it and he doesn't know what's going on. It's sort of an apocalyptic vibe, I guess, aesthetic that they're going for. But all the songs that are in there are part of this story. Like every time someone bursts out singing, the main character is like, what the hell's going on? Why are you singing? This is not how the real life works. And it's really great. And of course, we get as the audience that they're making a musical anyway. You know, it's really clever. But that's actually an example of how all the music in an art piece, either in a musical or in a film or in a podcast or whatever, can be sort of incorporated in your story.
Mm-hmm.
The Avatar example that I mentioned is definitely an example of sort of out of story music, you know? And I think the sort of shift or balance between that is super interesting. And you can really play with that if you think about it consciously.
I think musicals do it the most, like, the most obviously, thinking about the music as it plays into the scene and, you know, dramatically changing what the actors do depending on what track is playing. The degree to which the music impacts the storyline is seen like in different ranges, as if the musical is the most obvious. And then kind of, if you look at like movies, some scenes are perfectly fine without music, but music is kind of thrown on top. And how soon the music production team is entered or introduced to the process is kind of states how well they're integrated. There is an amazing animated series that just came out last year called Arcane.
I've watched it. Yeah. It's you so did? Great.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And every episode, they'd make a point to make one scene entirely tied to music.
Right. In, I've heard of this.
Usually, you could just throw on some random hype track on these big old fight scenes, but they made sure to time certain hits, certain lines, certain movements to the words of the song. Or as you're transitioning from one environment to another, the music just immediately changes and you can feel, the impact of when the music production team was brought into the process and saying like, oh, okay, so this is what's happening. Hmm. What kind of music are you playing? And depending on what music you have here, we're going to illustrate something else. And that's so hard to do, especially in an animated series. But when you do it right, oh, chef's kiss. So good.
Yeah. Totally agree with that. Yeah, it's so nice. I think in general, that series has a really refreshing approach on it. It also reminded me of the, I keep forgetting names on this show every time I have to think of something. Oh, it's called Samurai Champloo, I think. I haven't watched it entirely.
Oh, snap. It's like 20 years old, yeah.
I think so, yeah. But it's a pretty famous anime, I think. I kind of forgot the plot, I'm not going to lie. But the setting is like sort of, what do you call that? Like feudal?
Feudal Japan.
I don't know this English word, but yeah. Feudal Japan. It's like the samurai age where... You know, it's sort of medieval/samurai vibe. But then every music that's played is super hip hop or R&B, I should say. Yeah. And the contrast is super refreshing and interesting. And I think the same I felt with the Arcane series, even though it has a different, you know, aesthetic. But still, it's really, really well done in that one.
Yeah. Anime has a tendency to just pick very out there tracks to set the mood, even though it might be like anachronistic. Tapping into like R&B and hip hop in anime is definitely something that's been happening for a long time. Oh, that reminds me. Just recently, and this is just my inner like anime fan coming out. They dropped teaser. They dropped a teaser for the anime series Bleach to return after a long hiatus. It's been six or 7 years since the series ended. Now, Bleach came out in 2004, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the anime came out in 2004, and I've been a fan since like the first episode. So when the trailer came on, and then they pull out like the main character's theme song, right? And they've revamped it. They've improved on it. There's like new guitars behind it. There's like synths and pops. And I'm hearing like this hype track that threw me back to pre-teen years. And I'm just like, oh, it's back. It's back. Like, and all the memories are flooding back.
Amazing. I can picture the music this bad. Yeah, that's great.
I was just sitting there just looking at all the characters with all their updated graphics and art styles because, you know, new age, new artists. And then you hear the track that's been played every time the main character gets like super hype and excited, revamped and like improved for like the new era. I'm just like, oh, man.
So satisfying. So yeah, that's great.
Yeah, there's like the hidden nostalgia, man.
That's great.
Yeah, some anime tracks just never age. They just like, no matter when you hear them, they're so tied. They're tied so intrinsically just to certain characters and certain scenes that when you hear them, you just can't help but think of a certain a moment that really struck you. I have music that is tied to specific moments of my life, like my real life. And whenever I hear them, I start thinking about like people or places or events. And it's just, it really describes how music kind of sets the stage and it kind of prepares the listener for whatever, you know, whatever story is tied to it.
Yeah, that's really true. I think for me also, music is very much the most intuitive art discipline. People are probably going to disagree with me, but for me, whenever I listen to music, I'm the most easily transported, or how do you say that? Like, I really love music because it's making me able to access emotions very easily, unlike other art disciplines, which is kind of strange because I'm a visual artist, you know, I illustrate for a living, basically, but somehow music is to me super intuitive or more intricate or natural as an art discipline to express emotions, because it's so tied to your body or to a certain response or something that you have. Mm. And with visual art or with film or other types, you know, sculpture, anything.
Yeah.
I usually don't have that response, or it has to be so good that it triggers that within me. But I rarely have that. And I have that a lot if I hear good music, you know? Which is very interesting. And I think that's also why it's so powerful as part of another discipline or as part of a D&D game or as part of a movie, you know?
Yeah. No, I totally get it. Like in the field of music theory, like we're both musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Like the whole concept of major and minor keys is that this sort of note evokes a specific emotion, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you play the minor key if you want. You play the minor key if you want to make it a little more sad. You play the fourth chord variation if you want it to be suspenseful. And there's certain chords that lead to other chords that invoke a sense of buildup and resolution.
Yeah.
The fact that like use these combinations to evoke a certain feeling, that's the core of music at the heart of it, really. It's crazy.
That also, by the way, maybe to wrap this up, reminds me of how music can also quite literally be part of a story, not only, you know, in the Stargate way where people start singing and that's basically the plot.
Of course.
But also in like movies such as Kubo and the Two Strings, for example. I don't know if you've watched it.
Yes, yes, yes.
By sort of strumming his, well, guitar or something similar, he makes paper fold into place and he creates these magically folded origami pieces that help.
Mm.
In his journey. And you know, it's kind of the way he does magic. You know, it's the same in D&D again. The whole point of
a
bard,
exactly.
You can probably say this better than I am, than I can, but bards are really sort of, their music is their power or is their magic and the thing that makes them get shit done, you know?
And I know we were gonna close on that, and I totally agree that the phrase basically music is magic is pretty apt, like even in fictional media and in like real life. I think something that a memory that will never leave me and kind of set me on this path of just very much enjoying world building.
Mm.
When I was younger, probably like sixth grade, somewhere around that, I had a start that many, many creative minds of our era do, I joined like a writing board, like a role play board, where you would make a character.
Oh, okay.
And just kind of interact with other people's characters and just kind of learn to role play.
In text,
that.
You mean, right?
In text,
like as a forum,
in text.
Sort of.
Yeah, you know, it may probably not the best idea for somebody in sixth grade, but you know, it was like a fictional setting, and I'm pretty sure that the theme was like, it might have been Naruto or something like that. We all just made our own ninjas.
So maybe just to paint a picture here, is it like, because I know what this is because I've done this too, but it's basically, so you write a post and then people respond with an in-character response post, kind of.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, you talk as if you are this character that you've made up, and somebody responds in text of their character reacting to what you've done, and it's kind of step by step.
Yeah, it's like each paragraph is one POV and has a different author,
yes.
Kind of. Yeah.
And I'm just realizing how foreign that idea might be to people. Yeah.
If you're not, you know, if you're not familiar with it, it's pretty strange. But it's really great. Yeah. I've enjoyed that too.
And I remember I wasn't the best of writers back then, of course. It was really that kind of setting that set me up to be a more prolific writer. But I remember there was an adventure that like four or five people were putting together. And there was one guy in the lead of it. He was a bit older than most of us. Again, not something you should do in sixth grade, but probably in his mid-20s. And he was kind of taking us on this adventure. And I remember he made a post and it was like five paragraphs long. And at the top, he said, "All right, listen to this music track as you read this." And of course, you click it and you put it on. And it was like some mystical chanting music, something you would find like in the opening of an anime game.
It started
with like droplets of water, and then slowly opened up, and you can feel the music swelling and growing into what would be the reveal of a magical world. And as this guy wrote what was happening in his text, every beat of the song, he would have like a different paragraph describing what's happening. And I remember just the clearest visual ever. And it was that moment that I'm like, wow, I can see this. I can see all of this.
That's
right?
Amazing.
And,
yeah.
And that specific moment may have opened me up to just writing scripts, playing D&D, all of that. And to this day, I cannot find the music track.
Oh no!
I can't find it. I've looked for years and years and years. The board has been shut down. The website is shut down. There's no way to go back to it. But I remember nothing else so vividly as that exact post.
Oh, that hurts my soul. But it's so beautiful.
Yeah, that's
amazing. I love that you still have this memory that as sort of start of everything. That's great. Yeah, I feel like I know a lot of people that now do D&D or are actual like published authors that started in writing forums like that.
Yeah, of course. Like I remember it was him and one other person. Whenever they would have a conversation with each other in character, I got to witness like two expert storytellers just going at it.
Beautiful.
Like combating each other. Yeah. And it was just such a good experience.
Oh, so amazing. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. Music might be too broad a topic to handle in one episode, but you know, it is like between the two of us, there's plenty we could talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Is it all right if we bump to the next topic?
Of course. Yes.
Cool.
What
to continue
did you
onwards. I kind of touched on it a little bit when talking about why I loved that intro music to Bleach. Today's topic that I'm bringing is about main characters. So what my questions I want to bring for today is in the art of storytelling, what makes for a good main character? And how much does a main character impact the process of world building when it comes to writing? And my personal most difficult question, what are your favorite examples of main characters?
Ooh.
So I kind of wanted to start at the top because when you think of storytelling and you think of world building, in a lot of books, a lot of movies, a lot of media, the story revolves around one person in particular, and the world is kind of fleshed out around them or their perspective or worldview. So, off the top of your head, question for you: what do you think are the ideal traits or the most important traits for a good main character?
This is super hard to answer, I think, because this is one of the sort of most tricky questions to me, because whenever you're a good writer, you can kind of make it work, I feel like, even if your character is the most dislikable piece of shit there mm-hmm. is, you know, there's something to it that makes it work. But I think for me, what I most often respond to or relate to is quite literally that, when it's relatable. So if something is rooted in either a real person or someone that has traits that are a little bit like how I live my life, I can very easily connect with them. You know what I mean? If someone has a specific, for example, I find it very hard to get angry at people. That's just a thing I'm very bad at. Even though I feel angry, I can't really say it, you know? And if a character in a book or something has that too, or is struggling with that too, then I can relate, because that's my problem or my issue too. And it's very interesting that yeah, you sort of get a connection through recognition, I would feel. But then again, there's also characters that are super angry and super dislikable, like Azula or like any, you know, people that are so different from me. And then if it's interesting enough, it's harder for me to be convinced by them. But once I'm convinced, I'm really interested because it's so different for me, if that makes sense.
Right. I think one of the key points for a main character, just in general, I think this might be unilateral or universal across all main characters, is to feel empathetic towards them. Whether you agree with their viewpoints or not, the ability to kind of stand behind the main character, understand where they're coming from, and not necessarily agreeing or disagreeing with their choices, but really, once you accept their viewpoint or perspective, how they express that, you can be like, okay, that makes sense. You know, this is important to them, and I should do that. The main characters are such a hard topic, because even in world building and even in storytelling, at the end of the day, main characters are still a tool to tell the story. You know?
Yeah.
Because how you view literally everything you've created, how you view the world, and how you view the events that are happening is always through this, not always, but usually through the perspective of a specific person. So it's always skewed. It's a little bit skewed towards how they see everything. Like, some things are evil, some things are good, some things are bad, some things are favorable or desirable. And there's like different nuances to main characters, depending on how the author wants to use them. I'm thinking specifically in literary media, in books and such, for now.
Yeah.
Like, to pull back on something we talked about last episode, like Harry Potter. You want to take a main character, Harry Potter is a main character, you know? And and you see the dichotomy of good and evil through his eyes. You're told that, like, his family, his living family is mean, his friends are good, Slytherin is bad, Voldemort is evil. Like, things are kind of explained to you like that.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was younger, I was reading Harry Potter, and I was like, okay, that makes sense. I mean, he's a kid, I'm a kid, like, I get it. Like, these things are difficult for him, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then as the series progressed, I very distinctly remember on the fourth and fifth book, Harry was starting to make decisions that I didn't agree with. I was like, okay, but I wouldn't do that there, you know? I wouldn't get all hung up on this. I wouldn't. Like, you're being too hard on yourself, or you're being too angsty. Like, come on, just think about it logically. And sometimes Harry would fall into specific emotions, and I'd be like, okay, I have to understand where he's coming from to appreciate the decisions he's making. And that connection, or subsequently disconnection from a main character, very much fulfills how much a reader is invested in the story. Once they, if they can stand behind a character and root for them, the story is told in a much more visceral way, or it feels much more visceral to the person reading it. On the opposite side of the coin, not necessarily opposite, same genre, if you look at a character like, I think it's Bella from Twilight?
Sure.
The main character, a lot of criticisms of the Twilight series is that the main character is a self-insert, which is specifically a main character that is very simple and basic and easy to understand, to the point that the reader can feel like they can insert themselves into the story, kind of be like, oh, this could be me, that what they do could be what I do. And then they feel the story in a different way depending on what the main character experiences. It's like you're experiencing it, because it could very much be you. So when you're crafting a story, when you're kind of putting something together, you have to decide, is the character going to be relatable to a fault, to the point that the reader could very much see themselves in that position and kind of live vicariously through their decisions? Or is the character something that the reader has to come to understand, you know, their viewpoint, their perspective, yeah, their decisions. There's kind of that growing pain.
I was going to ask, is it then also that you felt less invested in the Harry Potter series when you were a little bit more disconnected from Harry's decisions?
I did feel like, I mean, it might have been just I was younger and, you know, I read the books like at a point where I just really liked magic and all that.
Also important.
Yeah.
Not to be mistaken here. Kind of, yeah.
And as your mind kind of developed like critical thinking skills, it's like maybe that wasn't the best call, Harry. You know, maybe you shouldn't have done that. You know, maybe you shouldn't have lashed out at your friend. But it's so easy to say that from an outside looking in as someone not in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it messed with my investment in the series, but it suddenly Harry Potter felt less like a this could be me book and instead felt like a let's root for Harry kind of book. You know, I see what he's going through and let me just stand behind him sort of deal.
I think there's also something, I think I'm going to call it tough love, that happens if you are invested in a series for a while, for example, Harry Potter, or I had this a little bit in The Hunger Games.
Mm.
Which ends like super tragically, but then I love Katniss so much that I just felt the anger and the sadness for her, even though I didn't like that she threw herself into things in the end or stuff like that. But then because you've spent so much time understanding and sort of knowing where they came from, you've sort of passed a threshold there, I feel, when you're so invested that whenever they do something stupid, it breaks your heart. Instead of that, you're like, oh, it's badly written. I'm like, Katniss, how can you? You know?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, there's a sort of difference to that investment or something. Even though then the character turns to shit or the character becomes annoying.
Yeah.
I mean, I still love Katniss. Don't get me wrong here. But it doesn't really matter because they're so realistic to you at that point that you just start judging them as if they were real, I think. And I would then be offended by the person instead of by the writer. You know what I mean?
That's got to be a testament to the author then. Like if you can be like, oh, I can't believe they did that, instead of saying, oh, I can't believe the author made them do that, you know?
That's really what you want, I think. Because then no matter how dislikable or stupid your characters are, you've made them believable and people start caring about them because they're angry about the person. Oh, this reminds me, by the way, of the whole sort of drama around The Last of Us 2. Laura Bailey and Ashley Johnson were in that series as voice actors, in that game, I should say. And then Laura apparently got a lot of shit thrown at her, like super scary emails and people hating on her online, stuff like that, because she played the villain in the series so good. Like, she was so good at her job that people started hating her for her work that she did, which is crazy to me, but also shows that you then, even though it's super shitty, of course, to get death threats or whatever the shit she had to go try. Yeah, you know, I can't, of course, talk about that. But I think it does say then that you have done such a good job that people are actively like offended by it, like in their heart. Instead of that, they're like, oh, I don't like this art piece. No, they actively dislike the person and start connecting the voice actor to the person because they're so real in their head that the real person becomes the character that they dislike in the video game series, you know?
Which is awful, like a backhanded but very compliment. Good. Yeah.
Then that must mean she's very good at what she does, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
This also reminds me, by the way, of characters that sort of lie to you as the reader.
Yes,
I think at one point I read a really good young adult novel. I think it's called The Graces by Laura Eve or Lauren Eve. I don't think I can talk about this without spoilers. So if you want to read it, stop here, I guess.
All right, here we go. First spoiler alert of the podcast.
Because at first it starts out as a sort of quite easy or simple main character, the way that you described, right? Like you can sort of place yourself in the situation and it's mostly the characters and the setting around her that's interesting and intriguing. There were like these three sort of witchy type siblings that were super interesting and impactful, and she wanted to be friends with them so bad because they were so cool and weird. And that's the whole first half of the book. And at some point you as the reader start to realize that the main character, I forgot her name, but that the main character is also not sharing things to these other characters that we're meeting
and
is also sort of holding back certain things out of her quote unquote mind, the thing that you're in. Like even her own thoughts are sort of refusing that she has this secret that she's carrying with her. And at the end of the book, finally that stuff comes out and that makes you so shocked because you really trust the sort of eyes that you're looking at this.
Yes, yes, yes.
Or looking through at this scenario, you know? And when things start to shift over there and you suddenly sort of can't trust your quote unquote mind, you know, the first person's mind anymore because they're lying their ass off all the time. It really gets even more intriguing because you don't know what's real anymore. And the whole sort of perception of things changes because you're not sure if that perception is right anymore.
Yeah. Have you ever watched a movie Shutter Island?
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it. No.
You should. So I can't spoil it for you.
Ooh,
but basically, okay. It's seen through the eyes of the main character, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go through the movie, you start realizing that things aren't all as they seem. It's a fantastic movie. People who are listening to this, they know exactly what I'm talking about. but it really plays into the fact that the perspective of the main character changes how you see the world around you, even though things might not always be exactly as they're envisioning it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Do you have any... Well, you already mentioned Katniss, but do you have any characters that stick out to you as like your favorite main character or like the favorite lead of any story?
Katniss is definitely one of them. And I'm not sure why. Well, I guess because it's just a real fucking good book. And then another one is actually Richard from The Secret History that I mentioned right at the beginning.
Okay.
Because he also has a little bit of those traits of supposedly seeming very simple or straightforward or sort of understandable in comparison to their surroundings, you know, but then becomes super, super more interesting as the plot goes on, you know. Maybe I just like that because I also love the Graces because of that reason. I don't know. Maybe it's a theme now.
Yeah.
I have to say I'm a very, very big children's literature nerd. So I love my Pippi Longstocking.
Of course, of course.
I love my Matilda from Roald Dahl.
Oh, yes. Great.
And I think that is a little bit because of what I said earlier. Like, if I can relate to a character and somehow I do that more with children characters or with younger main characters, because I think it has more of those sort of honest feelings in them than often adults' books can have, which is neither good nor bad, but it really resonates with me for that reason. So, you know, yeah. Those are pretty significant. Also because of the nostalgia, obviously. Yeah, but there's a lot of little girls that I have in my heart.
Yeah, that's great.
Do you have a favorite?
Even as I was building this topic, it was so hard to find a main character that I like. I feel like I keep getting drawn to secondary characters or like supporting cast characters.
Okay.
Possibly because their ideals and their design intrinsically are more like solid, you know, they don't change too much. So you know exactly what they stand for.
Right.
At a lot of points in the story.
Yeah.
Whereas the main character is supposed to be like either it's supposed to be you or it's supposed to be some growing, changing, dynamic character.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on the medium, but I think one of my favorite characters, just in general, actually, this isn't really as deep as it could be. But there's a series called Liar Game. It's a manga adapted into a live action.
I didn't know it. Oh, okay.
It's the main character's name is Akiyama, and he's just very, very smart. I think that's just, it's just fantastic. Like, the author is brilliant when he's coming up with these scenarios. And the way that the main character gets out of them is just something that you can never conceive on your own. And the reveal of how he figures it out and how he breaks things down in his own brain, which is like leagues ahead of everybody else in the room, is just very fun. And whenever he's challenged by somebody who's smarter than him, then you like to see him be challenged. You like to see him hit adversity and then like kind of one up the other smart person.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. You really get a sort of, I don't know the word, I think. How do you say that? Like expectation from the scenario then, if he constantly gets out of stuff.
The anticipation, I think.
Anticipation. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily like a depth of character. He's not super deep. And he does like a history and all that. But as much as I appreciate the growth of a character, the dynamicism of a main character, I like it when they're just smart, you know?
Yeah.
When they just make good decisions and it's like, yes, you're so right. Thank you. I totally agree with you 100%.
I love that. Yeah. You're just like 100% rooting for them because there's no sort of clouding of judgment.
Yeah. It just have the clarity of mind is just so refreshing. Sometimes characters are made to do things to further a plot point, even though it's dumb, or even though it's reckless.
Yeah. That annoys me so much. Then you're really, don't do that.
Yeah, it gets frustrating when like the main character has to like break their streak of what they usually do in order to serve as like a plot point.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I guess I just like very solid characters, but we think we've covered this well enough. Usually we wrap up our podcast with a world building prompt. I think
it's true.
You have one today. Is that right?
I have one. I have a humble prompt for you. Here we go.
Okay. Oh, wait. Someone asked me, what do you guys do with these prompts at the end of the story? And it's at the end of the podcast. And this is basically just an activity to kind of test ourselves, or a small exercise to see what we can do with just a core concept and how the process in fleshing out a world or idea around them. We don't actually do anything with these topics, but if you have any prompts that you'd like to send to us, we have a Gmail. Literally your rivers are wrong at gmail.com that you could send to, and we'll probably bring those up because
For sure,
we love interacting with you guys. So ready for the prompt.
Okay, are you ready for the prompt, Dante?
I can't promise you I'm actually ready for the prompt.
Here we go.
I'll do my best.
Here we go. It's only one sentence this time.
Okay.
And it's this one. Okay. One day the sun turns black.
Oh.
And that's it.
Okay. Hold on. I was expecting more, and then I just kind of realized the gravity of it. Okay. Oh, shoot.
Maybe let's clarify for 1 second. There's no sort of giant change in the world yet. People just look up and they see, that's weird. The sun is black.
Okay.
And then you go.
Okay. So are we talking like eclipse black, or like no light at all black, or like is there like a light but it's dark? Okay. Maybe I'm overcomplicating this. Mind is spinning.
Gosh. I can hear it all the way from here. Yeah.
Sending my vibes across the ocean. Sun turns dark. Yeah. I mean, people would obviously wake up in the morning, kind of be thrown that it's still dark outside. I'm assuming that you still see the stars and stuff, but there'd probably be like an ominous void in the sky. To tap into something else, there in Critical Role, the setting of Exandria, there are two moons, and one of them is specifically dark and reddish gray, to the point that you can't really even see it. But whenever you can see it in the sky, it kind of represents an ill omen. So just in the general disposition of people, if the sun turned black, everybody would see like, oh, this is the end of days. Like there's no way around it.
I guess so.
Even if it doesn't cause any change immediately, people would be very, very worried. There'd be a general sense of panic that sits in to places around the world. Obviously, all news outlets freak out about it.
People would read into it. Would people want to like solve it?
What is there to do? What is there to do?
Make like, how do you say that? Like conspiracy campaigns about it? Yeah, for sure. I know that already.
Of course. People are even doing that now. every religious sect in the world would try to attach meaning to this, whether it be the apocalypse, the changing of a new era, not to even mention the agricultural effects they would have on the world, that crops no longer have the sunlight to grow.
I did not think about that. Yeah,
unless like plants grow in dark light, but like evil. I mean, if you want to go that route.
It's like the Breath of the Wild one where you have like a red moon, and then all the things turn evil for like a hot second.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously,
who knows? Yeah,
you'd have to test like the permanency. Is this forever? Is this just for a couple of days? And if it was just for a couple of days, we would never stop talking about it. The day the sun turned black,
for sure.
That would be terrifying. You could take this and delve into the scientific things it would have, the impact it would have on the world in terms of like where we get our food supplies, things, how we change our mindsets in a world that's all nighttime. That
people would have like permanent winter depression, for sure.
There are places in the world that have sun for like 4 or 5 hours a day.
I know, it's crazy. Yeah, I think that's in Iceland or something, or in I don't know, Siberia, like super northward.
Exactly. And that's super sad. But at least they know that the sun still exists.
I mean, at least it changes around, you know, like the other half of the year you have sun all the time. So at least it's sort of balancing out.
Right.
But if you just don't have that forever, or at least for an unknowable amount of time. that's gonna be pretty depressing.
The sun rising in the east is one of the great constants of the world, I gotta say. and to throw that off kilter will really
very true. Yeah.
Throw people for a ride.
Yeah.
I just feel like, and it's so sad that we kind of have this apprehensive feeling, like in real life, just in general with, I don't want to go into it, but it's just like the idea or thought of, is this forever? When will this end?
Oh, you know? Yeah.
And that, I feel like that, the general sense of just, like the dread, I guess, just the coming to terms with this might be the state of the world forever, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's very much a sort of emotional prompt, this one.
Yes.
Not in terms of like, oh, we're so emotional about it, but in terms of this would really have the most impact on people emotionally rather than physically. Like, you know, the prompt we had last time with the wings, you know, it's a super literal, well, I mean, not literal, but kind of physical thing, right? And this is, I mean, it too is a physical thing. Like it's visible, I guess, or I mean, not visible, ironically. but it would really not have an impact except for maybe there being no light, which can have some physical consequences, you know?
Yeah.
But there's bigger consequences on the other side of things, which is the expressive emotional anxiety-ridden side of the world.
Yeah, like we could talk about the scientific implications as long as it's fun, but the real visceral foremost feeling is the emotion that's drawn out of it. Like how it feels, like not in your brain, but like in your heart, like what sort of weight does it put on it?
I think so. And I think this is maybe why I wanted to talk about this one is also maybe because I think some things really can have that reaction, like a very physical thing, like a random planet appearing or the sun turning black, can really fuck with people as a group or as an emotional being. And I think that's also one of the strengths of world building, that you can really sort of impact the other aspects of your story because of the world you're building.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be based in logic at all. Some things just evoke certain emotions. Like we talked about music, music pulling at emotional heartstrings isn't really a scientific thing. It just is, you know?
I guess so.
So the universal constants in our life, like the sun, like the people around us, just the environment in general, things that we've come to accept and things that like bring us happiness and other emotions, just kind of flip that, it triggers something in us that isn't entirely logical and isn't entirely scientific. That's just wild, right?
Well, it's interesting storytelling. Heyo.
Hey.
For sure.
Okay. Well, on that note, thank you for joining us in talking about the sun turning black.
Yeah.
Definitely one of the darker tones we've ended our podcast on.
No problem.
It happened. And that's just kind of what happened. So if you want to know what happens on our next episode of Your Rivers Are Wrong, you'll just have to tune in next week. Thank you so much for joining us. It has been a pleasure as always. Thank you, Merle, for your amazing prompt. And I just love this podcast so much.
I'm having such a great time. I can just talk about all the movies I want and all the musicals I want and all the D&D that I want.
Yeah.
It's great.
And all of that will happen next episode. Thanks for joining us. And as always, your rivers are wrong.
Yeah, they're pretty wrong.
Have a great one.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Rivers Are Wrong. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future episodes that you'd like to hear us cover, feel free to contact us at yourriversarewrong@gmail.com. Our intro and outro music is written by Maarten Schellekens. Thanks for that. And again, thank you so much for listening. We hope to see you at the next one.